it's not made right, it's not going to be reliable in its normally operating environment. So all test and inspection equipment of X-ray is part of is there to give some confidence that what you've done is good. Or if there's problems, to look at it non-destructively so you can try and find the fix before more serious and more expensive destructive tests. But I do acknowledge that if everything was made perfectly, no test and inspection equipment would ever be needed. But we don't work in that sort of environment. And so people are looking to test and inspect things because if there is an issue, it's much cheaper to fix it in the factory than it is once it gets out on site. And I would say the corollary is that the best companies I've been fortunate enough to work with and talk to, who have all sorts of, you know, they make the best circuits and as a matter of course, but they often also are the ones that invest most in test inspection to ensure that they maintain this level of quality.
That's my guest, Dr. David Bernard, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Welcome to another episode of Reliability Matters, brought to you by Aqueous Technologies. As children, we fantasized about having superpowers, to be able to fly, to be able to be invisible, to see through things. While most of these superhuman traits were relegated to comic books and Marvel movies, one such power is available to mere mortals. The power to see through barriers and inside objects. The miracle of X-ray technology has allowed us to see beyond what human eyesight can see. Discovered 124 years ago, X-ray technology has dramatically changed the medical industry, the security industry, and many industrial sectors, including the electronic assembly industry. X-ray technology is no stranger to my guest. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. David Bernard, an expert on X-ray within the electronic assembly industry. Dr. David Bernard is an X-ray consultant for the electronics industry. He has more than 15 years of experience in the use and understanding of X-ray inspection and test for the electronics industry. He has authored numerous publications and presentations on X-ray technology. In fact, I originally met David at an industry conference. David attained his doctorate in chemical physics from the University of Sussex in the UK. David joins me today from the UK. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks for the opportunity to participate.
I'm grateful that you agreed. We've come across each other's paths at various trade shows and symposiums and conferences and things like that, and I always enjoy talking to you about a subject that I don't understand a lot about, which is X-ray. So you're a wealth of knowledge, and I appreciate your willingness to fill my head with X-ray facts. It's always a very interesting subject. Just this magic technology of being able to look through something is still amazing to me. Now, David, you literally wrote the book, A Practical Guide to X-ray Inspection Criteria and Common Defect Analysis, all about X-ray in our industry. So tell me a little bit about your background and what led you to a career in X-ray technology.
Serendipity, really, blind luck, and whatever else you want to say. After leaving university, I've really worked in capital equipment, technical sales, that sort of stuff, but outside of the electronics industry and also the X-ray industry. And through a series of random paths, I ended up getting a job with one of the X-ray manufacturers just before they launched the start of their X-ray products, and that would have been the end of 2000. And that's how I got into X-ray. So I've got to be honest with you, what little, as some of your listeners will no doubt find out, I know is what I've got in the 15 or 20 years since then.
Interesting. I'm going to go on this little bit of a diatribe, and I promise it'll turn into a question. I tend to do that at the beginning of each one of these podcast episodes. X-ray technology has been around for a very long time. It was discovered by a German professor, William Conrad Röntgen, in 1895, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1901. While X-ray technology's was originally adopted for medical use. It wasn't long before it was utilized in industrial applications, including our own electronics industry. Prior to surface mount components, when electronic components were mostly through-hole or primarily through-hole, all of the solder joints were clearly visible, so they could be inspected either with the naked eye or with slight magnification. The introduction of surface mount components kind of changed that whole paradigm. Many surface mount components have their solder pads underneath the part, making it impossible to physically, with the naked eye or with just magnification, inspect the solder joint itself. The advantage of these surface mount components, of course, with the pads underneath the part, is we could put them closer together. We can increase the density. One of the drawbacks, though, was, as I mentioned, the inability to inspect the solder joint visually. This was solved with the use of X-ray technology. So walk me through the evolution of X-ray technology as it relates to the inspection of circuit assemblies.
Well, sure. I can't tell you when the first time this was done. But as you say, X-ray goes back in 1895. And the opportunity for X-ray is in electronics is exactly the same as the opportunity and how it's revolutionized diagnostic medicine in for the human kind. And that is, rather than have to cut into something to see what's wrong with it, you can see it non-destructively. And that's the opportunity that X-ray provides, seeing things and seeing through things non-destructively. And so I would say, off the top of my head, the electronics is certainly, for the type of X-ray tubes and the resolution, was certainly available from the 50s onwards. But when it was actually being used in anger, I wouldn't like to say. But I would say from the 80s onwards, then people were beginning to use X-ray more and more, mainly because you had the growth of ball grid arrays, where, as you said, all the joints are physically underneath the package. And whilst using something like a side-windowed a microscope, be able to maybe see the outside row of balls round it if you've got the time and inclination to do it, X-ray allows you to see all of it in the same way as you've got a suspected broken foot. You'd rather not have somebody chop your leg off to see, to prove the point. You'd rather have a non-destructive approach to look at it. So surface mount, and I would still suggest, and this is maybe something we'll talk about later, is that, you know, looking at through-hole joints with X-ray still has a lot of validity, but the driver for X-ray has been the ball grid array and more recently other bottom termination components such as QFNs and the like.
You mentioned something that intrigues me. Let's talk about that now. I've always considered X-ray in the electronics assembly industry to be to inspect things we can't see physically. You mentioned through-hole has an application for that. When I look at a through-hole board, I can see the actual solder connection. So we must be looking past that. What application does X-ray have with the inspection of through-hole components?
Well, one of the areas is how much of that through-hole is filled. And particularly where you've got connectors and very fine pin, many numbers of connections in a small place on the edge of boards, there are in the guidelines a suggestion that you want 75% more or fill. And actually seeing that optically of how much that fill is, 100% fill or over the top is fine. But you don't necessarily know if there's just a small covering over the top and there's nothing underneath. And having an oblique view of an X-ray image of a through-hole joint, you can get a very easy and quick confidence that the fill down those through-hole joints is complete and there's no voids in it.
When I was a kid in high school taking an electronics class, we had to learn to solder. And I remember my instructor coming up to me after I thought I successfully soldered two pieces of metal together. He told me I was solder sculpting. And I wasn't soldering. There was no metallic bond. I was just dripping molten solder over something to cover it. But there was actually no metallic, intermetallic bond underneath that sculpture. So I guess that's something X-ray could see, is like a cold solder joint or the as you've mentioned, the volume of solder under a connector where there's just, even though it's through hole, there's still a physical barrier to for vision.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in the past, you know, if you had a military or aerospace board, they'd have to physically destroy them to pull them out to get some sort of proof, or cut them away to get some sort, allow an optical check. But of course, it's a destructive test. So again, I wouldn't say that people would buy an X-ray machine for through-hole stuff, but it's not as though that through-hole has gone away. I know that everybody in the manufacturing process, that whenever a new technology comes along, it's going to kill the old one. But we've still got through-hole, we've still got BGAs, we've still got bottom termination components, and as and when the next things come along, embedded or whatever, they're going away. So they've still got value in it. And so you're looking for X-ray in particular for the hidden joints, but there's a lot of other value quality control you can do. And also from a manufacturing point of view, is you've got a very quick and easy non-destructive proof to show to your client that your through-hole joints are good and solid. The number of joints that I've seen where, you know, one or two, arguably the quality of the joint is still going to be good if it's 50% filled. But again, if you're working to the IPC guidelines, that may not be deemed acceptable.
So let's get into some IPC guidelines. One of the things our industry is concerned about is voiding, or, you know, for those who aren't in the electronics assembly industry that listen to this podcast, the absence of a soldered connection at a specific location on a component's pad, the equivalent of an air bubble, really. I would assume voiding may present a few legitimate concerns, including, you know, the potential reduction of the amount of electrical current capable of flowing from a circuit board into the component and out of the component, and the integrity of the metallic bond, which physically secures the component to the assembly, and the possible reduction of heat dissipation as a result of less of that bond. All that being said, I'm aware of the medical community's concerns of quote-unquote self-prescribed human imaging via MRI clinics, imaging clinics, where otherwise healthy people purchase a visit to an MRI machine only to find abnormalities, which they then demand that their doctors remove. And the result is often unnecessary surgery and risky surgical procedures. In the electronics world, with the use of our version of imaging, which is X-ray, is there a similar concern with the use of imaging technology on circuit assemblies? Are we seeing and reacting to abnormalities that would otherwise be non-problematic?
Well, actually, you raise a number of interesting questions. I'll try and address them. The first of all, I'm led to believe that the habit of people who go and have a full thorough check and have all this MRI and CAT scans and things like that, allegedly, they're known in the medical trade as vomit for victims of modern imaging technology.
And
that's a separate issue to what we're discussing. And I would say that there isn't a direct analogy within the electronics, because it's a second order thing that we're doing. We're looking for test and inspection. We're not making more of it, but we're making sure that what goes out the door is right. And in the question of your reliability talks, it's a question of, if it's not made right, is not going to be reliable in its normal operating environment. So all test and inspection equipment of X-ray is part of is there to give some confidence that what you've done is good, or if there's problems, to look at it non-destructively so you can try and find the fix before more serious and more expensive destructive tests. And but I do acknowledge that if everything was made perfectly, no test and inspection equipment would ever be needed, but we don't work in that sort of environment. And so people are looking to test and inspect things because if there is an issue, it's much cheaper to fix it in the factory than it is once it gets out on site. And I would say the corollary is that the best companies I've been fortunate enough to work with and talk to, who have all sorts of, you know, they make the best circuits and as a matter of course, but they often also are the ones that invest most in test and inspection to ensure that they maintain this level of quality. But then we come back to voiding. Now, voiding or air bubbles, and another analogy that some of your listeners may know is, you know, for example, welds, pipe welds and things like that, having a void in a weld could be catastrophic. Now, we're not looking quite the same thing within the electronics. If you can imagine, these are BGAs or ball grid arrays. These are little solder balls physically underneath the package, and during the reflow profile, that's when the solder heats up, chemicals, flux comes out of it, and it's possible that air bubbles can be trapped inside because the solder re-solidifies before all this volatile material escapes. Now, what it all means is actually a debatable point, and it depends on the device concerned, and also what is deemed to be acceptable. In the guidelines, the IPC guidelines for ball grid arrays, there are some recommended guidelines. For example, says you should have less than 25% voiding. That's usually an area measurement because you're looking at a three-dimensional object. But if you're looking from the top down, you've got a 2D area. And within an X-ray image, the void will be an area of low density or white compared to the darker density or black that will be the much more dense solder material. So within an item such as a BGA, voiding may not be a terrible issue. And it's also a question of where that voiding occurs. You could imagine that most voiding, most air bubbles are trapped in the middle. That's not going to particularly affect the transmission of electrical current through that joint. Voiding at the edges or things like that where it's joined to either the pad that's on the board or to the device, it may, I don't know if it will dramatically affect the electrical circuitry. I don't have enough information to be explicit on that. But within a BGA environment, people want to be sure that they are meeting their guidelines. And I would argue that if you have a problem with voiding, they actually show up because they are very obvious in the X-ray. If you have a little bit of voiding, that's unlikely to be an issue. And I would say for voiding in ball grid arrays, it's more important to keep an eye on it and say, if I've got around about 5 to 10% voiding for most of the time, but then in one batch I've got 20 or 30%, whilst the joint itself may not necessarily be at fault, the question says is, what's happened to your solder paste or other things in your process that things have changed on a week-by-week basis? And arguably, I would suggest that's where voiding and an increase in voiding, if you sort of monitor it over time, has a very great use. But where there is an issue potentially more serious are on the bottom termination components. These are such things as quad flat, no leads, QFNs. And these are flat objects where rather than solder balls underneath, they are pads. And it's often that you have a large central pad covering a large area in the center of these devices that are used either as ground planes or potentially as well as heat dissipation. If you've got voiding in those, then that means you don't have physical contact in the areas of void between the device and the board, and that could make that component run hot and therefore outside of the specification again. So I would say is BGA's voiding, you're meeting guidelines, and does it tell you something about your process? When it gets to things where you're physically using it as heat dissipation, then you have to be more circumspect.
I would imagine heat dissipation is a real priority at the moment with the explosion of electronics in automobiles, and in particular electric automobiles, where we're running very high voltages, lots of current through circuit assemblies, more so than a quote-unquote typical electronic application.
I mean, absolutely. A lot of work goes on with all the solder paste manufacturers and things like that, all having low or zero voiding, they will claim. But the point is, the materials, vary over time and how they're being used, and somebody's left a pot of paste out on the side for two. There are things that happen in manufacturing, and therefore, it is when it comes to high power, high current, and as you say, the automotive is a perfect example, that's where much more control and concern has to be over the voiding, because of course you don't want your batteries overheating in your electric vehicle.
No, certainly not. There's a big talk right now about AI, artificial intelligence. Based on your experience, is AI creeping into the X-ray business? Is there, and if it isn't, can you see a time and a need for AI to come into the X-ray business or the inspection business in general, so that it's not an operator, it's not a technician trying to determine, you know, how much white, how much dark are they seeing? Can artificial intelligence be integrated into that technology to produce, you know, maybe reliability forecasts or pass fails in a more consistent manner?
Well, you ask a very good question. Obviously, AI is the flavor of the year, and everybody's talking about AI and what it can do, and the machine learning and other sorts of equivalent terms as I see them. Certainly, there are people who are bringing out AI, but I don't consider myself a Luddite, somebody who's going to break the looms of it, but I am a bit more concerned about the issues underlying AI. Because it's always a question of, if you've got predictive data where you've just got single data bits that people are sending off of their social media or others, then there's prediction, and arguably the data set, whilst huge, is relatively limited and modest, and there's going to be a consistency over that data set. When you're getting to electronic circuits, the smaller the volume, the question is, have you seen all of the available failure modes you're likely to see? And until you see more and more of them, you're then trying to say as well, how good is your test? The analogy I used to give, I think it still has a validity, is that if you go to the hospital, you've got a pain in your stomach and you have an X-ray taken of it, at this moment, the most likely cause, and up until the last couple of years, there was no other choice, your X-ray was put on a light box, and the radiologist, who had many years experience looking at pictures similar to those of your stomach, pronounced on their expertise. Now, they're not infallible, and people are working in the medical field where, of course, you've got so much data, and the underlying image set are much more similar. When you've got the electronic circuits, my concern is the more complicated the board, single-sided, double-sided, you've then got different components. And with a single X-ray image, you're looking through different sort of objects, top side and bottom side, you're seeing all layers simultaneously. It's a much more complicated picture. So I think from my point of view is AI is coming in, but it's also a question of trying to make the simple, you know, the low-hanging fruit, as I think we should call it, can you do some stuff there? But once you get to the more complicated stuff, I think you are pushing the envelope. And also there is the question about the fragility of the data set. I know there are some tests that have been done is that, you know, a small underlying change of the image, whether that's caused by a detector change or an X-ray tube change or other sorts of things, is does that affect the information that you get? Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't going to try and put consistency and into their data sets by looking at the same grayscale levels on standard systems. But also underlying it, as I understand AI, is it comes up with an answer, but you don't know why. Then the question from my electronics point of view is, if you test the same boards as your data set on the same on different systems, do you get the same algorithm? If you keep finding the answers, does it matter? And that's a fair point. But there's a whole underlying thing is variability. If it's only doing it on one machine and you get consistency on it, maybe it's good enough. But your business grows, you buy another machine. Can you necessarily expect it to have the same thing? So because you're dealing with an image, two-dimensional or even with CT scans, 3D, you've got so much more information. And the data set on which it's based, I would argue, have you got enough good data compared to the medical environment or the social media environment where huge amounts of data and arguably the envelope may be more narrow? Perhaps I'm sounding a little bit against the trend, but I think, you know, there are areas where it can be used, but are there areas where it also should be used? And I would argue that are we asking the right question of the AI? And these are, you know, not necessarily always so obvious. I hope you don't mind me having a bit of a
rant. No, I love it. I think there's definitely a difference between denial and skepticism, and skepticism in my experience has always been very helpful. To be a hopeful skeptic, like, hey, this sounds great. I'm not quite there yet, but I hope it is everything they say it will be. But, you know, I don't know if I were a patient, you know, trying to determine if an organ has to be removed and that decision is made by a radiologist, you know, I don't know if I would want to trust that decision to a machine or a radiologist who has, you know, who's 2 days away from retirement that has 60 years of practical experience. So, you know, I don't know. It's a question of, you know, do you want an autopilot to land on the Hudson, or do you want Captain Sully to land on the Hudson? I think I'd go with Captain Sully, you know,
But then again, the counter argument is equally valid, is that says, well, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs of autonomous vehicles, they're far safer than people because people are far too unpredictable. So it's unfortunately, it's overhyped at this moment in time.
I agree.
And therefore, it's being applied to all things for all applications. Right. And I think there definitely are some very good opportunities, but the further and more difficult you make it, I mean, there are these terms that sort of come and go. I guess AI, do you remember the term fuzzy logic?
Absolutely.
That was popular for a while. And arguably it's the same sort of stuff. And this is where, if you can come up with a good pass-fail criteria, and this all sort of comes down to the whole concept of test. A bad test is worse than no test, in my opinion. Because if you're re-inspecting everything because you don't trust it, and this goes from the medical to all the sorts of stuff, is what's a good test? How confident can you be in it? Because nothing's perfect. And the more perfect you try and make it, the more false calls you end up having, because you're trying to ensure you don't get an escape, something that is bad but is passed. And as the corollary of that is, you end up having lots more that are marked as failures when they're not, so you've got to reinspect. So there's always a balance for it. And so I think it's amazing what AI can do. But I think realistically, at this moment, you've got to try and stick to more simple images, because the more complex images and the more complicated, and particularly the boards that are being made today, unless you've got a large data set, I'm concerned that, you know, how good that test is. But, you know, in terms of the medical side of things, I think one of the areas where there's a lot of research in AI is on mammography and breast screening and things like that. And I know that I don't have the data to hand, but there is a lot of evidence that the AI screening is as good as the human screening. And so there is a question if it's a different thing for a medical environment where there are person involvement to perhaps a second order in a manufacturing process. They both have the same issue, but I would say is that the sheer history of breast screening in particular, you've got billions of x-rays, billions of data, and you can build up, and it's not an easy situation because what they're trying to look at there is very subtle and very small. And, you know, there's a whole variety, but within the sort of cohort, you could probably see there's a boundary in electronics. There's a much wider envelope, as I would see it.
Yeah, I agree. And your description of mammography, certainly there's probably a greater application of imaging just in that one field than maybe all others combined, because it's a routine. And if we're going to teach a robot to, or a computer to make decisions, that's certainly probably the largest sample base compared to electronics.
But the part of the problem with that particular situation is that what I understand they're looking for are things, I believe, like microcalcification. These are very small features with relatively low density against a relatively low density background. X-ray is a relative absorption technique. So solder and no solder is quite nice. You've got a nice metal containing material and a void has air. So the density difference is large. So the image, the contrast on the screen is quite clear. When you get in the medical environment, and particularly for breast screening, what they're trying to look at is very small, and the density difference. And therefore, seeing this stuff is even for the human operator is difficult. It may be better for the machine operator and the machine operation. But then again, what is it looking at to find the fault?
Right. In the electronics application, it's quite literally black and white. In the medical field, it's shades of gray, to carry that analogy even further.
Well, as I said, in terms of the comparison, yes, but within the electronics industry, I would say it is still shades of grey, because as you know, electronic is one of those amazing areas where everything gets smaller every few years. It doesn't get bigger. Sure. And not only do the joint sizes get smaller, the amount of material that each joint or equivalent feature has is less. And therefore, the amount that it blocks in the X-ray is less. Therefore, the difference, the density difference you see becomes less. And remember, we're trying to look at these density difference over the thickness of multi-layer boards with copper tracks in and things like that. And you're trying to see all of these and look for relative differences. So state of gray is still, in fact, it's a very valid term for the electronics
industry. Maybe even more now than in the early days of X-ray on electronics. For the reasons you mentioned.
Absolutely.
You know, just to fall off the cliff for a second, a few minutes ago, you talked about autonomous cars and you know, you think they're very safe over humans. I agree. I've argued with, not argued, kind of friendly debated with friends about autonomous cars. I have some friends that go, I would never step in an autonomous car. They're so unsafe. Like, well, the only reason they're unsafe is because they can't predict random human behavior very well. The moment everyone is in an autonomous car, it'll be completely safe, or as safe as it can possibly be. It's us humans that they cannot predict. And that's kind of an example of AI. How much can AI predict? How much of the unpredictable can AI predict?
You are preaching to the converted there. I totally agree with you. I mean, there were studies that everybody thinks they're a better than average driver. Well, that doesn't compute really
right.
Mathematically.
Right.
And you're exactly right. It goes back to electronics and other things. What is a well-conditioned system? If you have a well-conditioned system and it keeps to itself, it's fine. It's when you add random events. And I'm afraid we are the random event.
We're the reason why autonomous cars are a bit dodgy at the moment, because they can't predict the crazy person in front. They can't predict the bicyclist that's going to dart out from left to right or right to left unpredictably. They just can't predict all that. They can't predict a dog running into the street or a kid chasing a ball. They can see it and they can react, but they can't predict.
Exactly. And to be fair, it could be argued that we as humans are even worse at doing it. And again, stopping the vehicle, an autonomous vehicle is going to stop much
sure.
quick, much
reaction
quicker
time will be
than a
very
human
fast.
Person.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this is, you know, the things are, but again, how safe is safe? It's a very good question. But of course, there are however many billions of miles or millions of miles that have been traveled by the autonomous vehicles that exist. Of course, it's a small number of vehicles. But the point is, it is getting, you know, there's huge amounts of data, the envelope. But somebody was telling me once that in the early days, I can't prove the veracity of this, but they came to a four-way intersection, and opposite in a driving car, but opposite there was a guy on a bicycle, but rather than putting his feet down, he was standing on the pedals balanced, and this completely threw the autonomous vehicle.
Yeah. Right. That's not supposed to happen. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the sheer availability of processing power, computational power, and which has been used in the X-ray field to make 3D X-ray or CAT scans, tomography, become very, very possible. And that gives another dimension, if you pardon the pun, to looking at X-rays. You're not just looking in 2D. You can also look in 3D.
Right. Let's talk about that. Yeah, first, thanks for bringing us back to X-ray. I could talk about autonomous vehicles and AI all day long, but thanks for bringing us back to X-ray. And you brought up something that I was just about to ask. How much of the image produced by a modern X-ray machine is the actual image? And are there technologies that enhance that image based on, I don't know, computer modeling or some form of AI or whatever, that makes the image more viewable and more readable by the technician who's viewing it?
You ask almost a metaphysical question. is the answer to that. And it also relates to how the majority of us see, depending on which websites you look at. The human eye doesn't distinguish shades of grey very well. Anywhere between 40 and 80 levels is the typical numbers that people say. We are much better at appreciating difference in colour levels. And of course, the standard X-ray picture is a grayscale image. So this is where machines are much better, because they can see much greater bit depth. So you may have 256 levels, 512, 1000. You may have loads and loads of gray levels that the detector gives you, but the human eye, even the most experienced, is not going to be able to see more than 40 to 60 of that number. So a lot of X-ray images, standard images you see at meetings and technical papers and things like that, they've all had enhancements, usually contrast stretch, which, you know, is like a rudimentary Photoshop type approach. Now, arguably, you haven't modified the image from that was captured. You've just stretched the grayscale to make a contrast easier to see for the human eye. But there are other levels that you can do, like enhancements, like you get on your smartphone and everything like that, where you can enhance edges, sharpen and do things like that. Now, arguably, you are modifying the image because you are sharpening things. So for what my metaphysical point is, if you stretch the contrast to give the human eye some better contrast, I don't think you're modifying, you're altering the output, but the image remains consistent. Once you start sharpening and things like that, technically you are modifying the image. How much? That's a question of debate. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, completely. Is this modification of the image done, is that performed by the technician, or is that done in a more automatic kind of behind the scenes method?
Well, if it's a manual type X-ray inspection, then most X-ray machines that I'm aware of will allow contrast enhancement and sharpening sort of filters, a very small subset of things, in order to enhance the image. Now, an experienced operator is going to be able to appreciate what they're seeing without the need for that. But if you're trying to explain to the client or your boss, you may need to accentuate the image like you would in other areas. So for a human operator, experienced operators may not need to enhance an image, but if you're trying to explain what's there and to try and stretch things, you will need it. If you have an automatic analysis, then arguably you don't want any enhancement put into it, because any enhancement could affect any algorithm you're trying to look and read. You want to have the basic image, and of course the automated analysis has the opportunity of looking to a much greater level of grayscales and other sorts of stuff. So if you start enhancing those images, you then have to think about, well, are they going to be consistent? So for example, today you've got a certain feature in an object that's got a grayscale level of 200. Tomorrow it might have 205. Now, if you start enhancing those to things like that, they may become, in a processed image, 205 and 250, for argument's sake. And therefore, it makes it easier for the human eye to see, but there isn't going to necessarily be the same consistency if you repeat it from a machine environment.
So this may be a naive question, but if X-ray technology and the computers that are behind it can detect hundreds of shades of gray, and the human eye can really only, and brain can only discern 40 shades of gray, what stops the X-ray technology from converting 100 shades of gray to 100 different colors of 100 different colors in a spectrum, so that it pulls out the different shades of gray, making it easier for the human to see the difference? Is that a silly question, or is that something that happens today?
No, it's not a silly question. And these filters, like on the social media stuff, you can put a false color and assign a false color scale based on your grayscale level. But then again, the question is, what color is pink? Is it grayscale level 200 to 205,
right,
or is it 190? So what I would say is...
So it's not so much gray humans can't discern too much. It's just subtle shades of color.
It's subtle shades of gray we can't distinguish. We can see subtle shades of color much better.
Okay.
Now, I would, and without any basis in fact, say it's perhaps because we've evolved to look for the tiger in the undergrowth, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Whereas when we've not used to be seeing in grayscale. And so it's more a question of, my personal thing is, there used to be sort of false color filters that you can put on. But for most X-ray people, it gives you too much of a shock, a visual shock, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, you've got so many colors, it looks pretty, but I don't know if it necessarily helps to make your identification. And if you like, although we're not so good in seeing grayscale, by stretching the contrast, and there are usually sliders and buttons to sort of adjust it, I think my belief is you get a better analysis, whereas in a color mode for an X-ray image, I think it's because we don't do it, maybe, that we don't use it, but I think it would be just too much information.
Got it.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So as far as, in our industry, probably more than others, things change awfully fast. And what is current and relevant and high tech today is obsolete and coral reef material, a few days later. So in the world of X-ray, for people who are in this industry who are running X-ray machines and they've been doing it for some time, is there a generation of X-ray machines that are still in use today that really should be turned into coral reef material that are obsolete and less relevant? Is there that much change in the X-ray industry to cause the need to upgrade on a regular basis, like they would in ovens or pick and place or cleaners or whatever the case may be?
Yes, up to a point. What I would say is there have been some technological changes over the last 20 years. One has been X-ray tube technology. This is the X-ray light source that the samples are bathed in. So the X-rays pass through the sample, and depending on the density of the materials that they're passing through, you get a differential absorption of the detector. So there has been some improvement in the type of X-ray tubes, and there's most definitely been an improvement in the X-ray detectors that are used for electronics. Historically, the electronics industry was using the equipment for detectors that was used in the medical field because it was commercially available at a reasonable price, whereas it was too expensive to make them for a unique application. But I would say, again, in the last 20 years or so, the technology of the detectors has been far more focused on electronic applications, and that's allowed much better pictures. But in terms of obsolescence, I've said this before, and I have to stand by it, is if you can see what you want to see, your X-ray machine is good enough.
Good enough. There you go.
However, with everything getting smaller and smaller, the resolution of what you can see and the grayscale sensitivity by the absence of material. I mean, we're talking of bumps that are 20 microns in diameter. We're not talking BGA balls of 300 microns or 1 millimeter in diameter. These are the ranges of sizes of things. And now you're getting to through silicon vias that are of the order of 10 microns in diameter. So it's not just the small feature size. You've also got the lack of material there that you're trying to fog your film, if I can use an old fashioned term. And so what I would say is, magnification is probably what's going to define when your X-ray machine may not be fit for purpose, because can you see the smaller and smaller features that you're having to put onto your boards? And then the other side of the thing would be, you can't just afford to look from a top-down view. You need an oblique angled view. And for technical reasons that I probably won't bore your audience with, is that getting an oblique angle view may or may not result in loss of magnification of the image. And so if you've got a small object and you want to see an oblique angle view, but you lose magnification through doing it, I would argue that makes it less efficient than a system that would allow you to see and not at an angle view but without a loss of available magnification.
And that comes with newer technologies. I'm assuming that a 20-year-old off-the-shelf X-ray machine will not have as much magnification or oblique angle choices as a typical off-the-shelf machine purchased yesterday?
It depends on the machine, I have to be honest with you. And like everything, there is a range of pricing for equipment. And like so much, you pay less money, you get less stuff. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
But ultimately, if it's good enough for your needs, therefore, why not? But ultimately, once you start using it, you then find out what else you could use it for along your factory, you know, inspecting boards after placement, but before reflow, you know, just to see, to give you some confidence that the paste looks all right. Maybe small in number, you can do it, but you can do those sorts of things looking at incoming inspection of sealed reels of components. There's required a lot of interesting component counting in recent years. Now that's slightly different than electronics because these equipment are in the areas where the components are stored. There, people want to know, do I have enough components to make these boards for my client? And so they've got a partial reel or something like that. So there has been sort of a new area in the last 5 years or so where people are actually just counting reels, and that's separate to the traditional, if I can call it that, electronics, looking for post-reflow of solder of electronic components and devices.
Interesting. And that is a perfect application for AI because components on a reel are predictable. We know where they're supposed to be. They're either, you know, it's either there or not. It doesn't have to do a lot of discernment. That's a very interesting application. Just throw a roll, a reel into an X-ray machine, and it could give you a pretty accurate count within a few seconds.
Absolutely. And I said, there are a number of equipment, standalone computer, but if you like, that's in the goods, in the goods part of the factory. It's not necessarily on the factory floor,
right,
where you're looking for the things like that. And so it's X-ray for electronics, but it's a different area. And of course, the argument is it's as valuable as testing the quality of it, because if you haven't got enough components to make your customers the boards, that's going to delay the shipment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And that's a very good economic argument. But as I said, I would say those standalone machines are out with the sort of traditional electronic stuff right. We've been talking about so far.
Inventory control versus quality control.
Absolutely.
So let's a couple more questions, then we'll wrap this up. We're going to try not to kill you with this question, David. If your life depended on the ability to properly inspect a circuit assembly, you cannot make a mistake. Make a mistake, you die. What would the perfect X-ray machine look like in terms of technology, features, capabilities? You know, build your perfect machine and describe that to me.
I think you've got to divorce the technology, which I can give some good suggestions of, to the skill and competence of how the analysis is being done.
That's
whether it's
point.
By an expert operator or an artificial intelligence system that we've done. There are X-ray tubes out there that have, relatively speaking, very good resolution, as in they can see small features such as the 10 micron or so features that I mentioned. But there are other X-ray tubes out there for various technical reasons where their resolution may be of the order of much larger. So if you've got a resolution of 1 micron, for argument's sake, and you're looking at a 10 micron object, and you've got another tube with a resolution of 100 microns, and you're looking at a 10 micron object, you can't look at the 10 micron object on that other tube. So there's resolution, but there's also the ability to move the sample to get to where you want, and also to position the object at an angle or the detector and the tube at an angle, so you can see things at different angles, because what it looks like in one angle, because you've got all layers simultaneously, may look very different and weird from another angle. My comment on expertise is, if I'm an expert, it's only because I've seen more pictures than you. And just, and we touched on this earlier about, is there something wrong? Well, just because it doesn't look right doesn't mean that it is. My mantra is, do you have consistency? Do all of the features of a similar type look the same? If they do, you've got two choices, 100% good or 100% bad. You can't forget the 100% bad side of it. And well, a friend of mine was doing a test for a customer a long time ago, and he said, I was looking at the BGAs and I was looking at angled views, and they all look consistent. And I said, look, they all look consistent. And I took the board out, turned it upside down, and the BGA fell off. So that was the 100% bad scenario.
But consistent.
But consistent, exactly. But if you've got variability, again, it doesn't guarantee that you've got a problem. It may be that the tracks and pads are coming from different angles and it looks different. But again, you're more suspicious. You said earlier, you know, are you a vomit? I don't think that's valid, because I say, just because it looks different doesn't mean there's a problem. But you can't necessarily reject it outright. Sometimes it's most difficult. You've got some of these BGAs have 1,000 solder balls or more. Trying to find one failure in that for a human operator, when if you go to a low magnification, you can only get a few pixels per ball. And then you go to a high magnification, you've got much better information, but then you've got only 20, 30, 40 balls on a screen to see. So there are lots of different issues behind it. But in terms of the technology, you want to have a good X-ray tube. And there are a number of types out there that I won't bore your audience with. You've got a manipulator to allow you to move around the sample quickly, easily, and get to the views you want to do. You then want a detector with good grayscale sensitivity. There are some technical issues underneath that, even though the human eye may not be as good at seeing it, but then you can use software to enhance it. You've also got to have something that's safe, so you need to have some sort of shielding around your device so that everything's safe for the operator. And then, of course, as I said before, you want to be able to take good images and get experience of what are, I would call, good and good bad examples, so you build up expertise and knowledge like a radiologist would do in a hospital. Perhaps, is that the best way I think I can answer your question?
Yeah. And just to kind of recap that, in no particular order of significance, resolution is a consideration, the movement,
magnification,
resolution, the movement of the image throughout the part, the tube,
the X-ray tube, the resolution of the tube,
right, the grayscale sensitivity, it being safe, and having a good reference material to
absolutely
discern pass fail. A lot of this, it sounds like half of the criteria to have successful X-ray images is the machine, and half of it is what we'll call HI, human intelligence and experience, as opposed to AI.
Well, you were kind enough to mention the book I wrote, which is now 14, you know, quite a few years ago now. And the reason I wrote it was because people said, we'd spent money on an X-ray machine, what the heck do we do with it? And the question is, the only way really is to show some examples as a way of saying, well, look for what is, as I said before, difference in consistency. And therefore, if you can, here's some sort of relatively simple examples. You're probably not that fortunate. Get your own boards and build up your own expertise. And I'm afraid experience is, I've seen more than you, until AI supersedes us.
Many years ago, late 70s, early 80s, my father came home with a IBM PC. First time I've seen a portable, you know, quote unquote, portable computer. And I was excited. I was a geek. I was a nerd in school. So I was really excited to, I got a computer at home I can play with. So I remember turning it on and it booted up, and it just had this green screen, monochrome green screen. and it flashed a C on the screen, flash a C prompt. And I typed in something, and of course it didn't know what to do. It spit out something. And I remember this crashing feeling of, I've got this great computer, but what do I do with it? And it doesn't seem to do anything. I didn't really understand at the time the concept of, you know, loading software and, you know, et cetera. I'm just excited to have a computer. That's kind of to your point of X-ray machines. I mean, anyone can buy an X-ray machine, but someone has to understand how it's used and interpret the data. And, you know, an X-ray machine, just buying an X-ray machine and taking snapshots of your product is useless. It has to be read. In the medical field, you know, we have radiologists that have a specific degree in reading these things. And in other applications, you know, we've got people on the line that are reading it. And if they don't have a lot of experience, if they've never seen an X-ray before, they're going to miss a lot of things.
Well, this is that right. And nobody is an expert from day one. And this is where I think the software, the graphical user interfaces, this is where the systems are much, much easier to use. You know, in the old days, there were joysticks and things like that to move the sample around, which meant that only somebody with that sort of dexterity got to use the equipment. Maybe I'm being a little bit harsh, but these days, everything's mouse-driven, so you can move to where you want to go, and the manipulation is done for you. So I would say, not just the technology's moved on in the last 20 years for electronics, but also the ability to see those excellent images has been de-skilled, such that line personnel are more than capable of operating the machines, getting that information, and ultimately becoming the experts. I mean, you know, what I would say is that, you know, when I've done doing training, people, you know, you show them and you give them examples, and then within a very short space of time, they're telling you because they are familiar with it. And it's a question of also not just doing it, but also doing it on a regular basis.
Sure.
When I've been training for like tomography, which is a more complicated CAT scanning, more complicated technique, it's not that much more complicated if you understand the basics, but within the electronics world, often it is used far less frequently than 2D X-ray. And because the interfaces tend to be more complicated, people, if they're not using it every day, you lose the, you know, use it or lose it, so to speak,
right?
Like a foreign language or something like that. So there are questions about that. But what I would say is, for people, I think X-ray offers some very good information in the electronics environment, but it's not the only piece of equipment. You've got to think about optical inspection, you've got to think about solder-based inspection and other sorts of piece of equipment that your budget will allow. But obviously, I couldn't say X-ray is the first piece of equipment you buy, but I think most people end up considering it a valuable part of their capabilities, not only for spotting things that you may have done wrong, but legitimately being as part of their quality control and also explanation of the level of quality they put into their products when presenting to their customers.
It's a member of the quality control orchestra.
Perfect. Yes, much more elegant phrase than I could have thought of. And, you know, this is it. So, but again, like all the equipment, if everything was made perfectly, you wouldn't need any of this kit. But yeah. I said is, but if I was a better salesman, I'd say, well, but how do you know?
Right. Exactly. I get it. Last question. Since a lot of this, people who might be new to X-ray, or X-raying products that are new to them, either way, there's a lot of kind of, just like in our industry, probably a little bit of black art to discerning and understanding what they're seeing and making, you know, pass, fail, go, no-go decisions based on what they're seeing. You are an X-ray consultant. Do you work with people who buy X-ray machines and help them understand how to use it? Do you help them purchase machines? What is the basis of your consultancy?
I'm not proud. I'll do almost anything for money, but no, but I'm not serious. It's more a question of there are the equipment manufacturers, companies, training. It's a whole, people, you know, staff turnover, so expertise may be lost. And so the opportunity of new people and refreshing on sort of, you know, the basics of what you're looking for. As I said, is X-ray, again, like any test equipment, use it for what it's great at, you know. Don't necessarily, like we discussed with AI, push it into areas where maybe the results are not necessarily going to be as good as you would hope. So the optically hidden joints, the BGAs, the QFNs, and all these sorts of things. So from a consultancy basis, it's a question of helping people to understand what X-ray is about, and hopefully being an advocate for what I believe, and has been very good to me, a useful technique that offers good, non-destructive testing and offers you the opportunity not to screw up.
Do people ever send you images, digital images, and ask for your feedback on them?
They do. They do. And again, it's not that I'm happy to do it, but it's also a question of context, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Often there's a whole variety of X-ray machines out there, and therefore the quality of the images that you get. And as I said, is I've seen very good pictures and I've seen not so good pictures. So if you're trying to see a small feature on a not a good image for whatever reason, it does make it very challenging. But you're absolutely right. You know, people send pictures, what about this? And also you have to be a bit cautious, because like any human interface, there is a saying that says if you've got 12 experts, you will get 15 opinions. Mm-hmm. So again, you have to factor that into the idea.
Right, right. Someone's racing.
Yeah.
Someone's
sorry
in a hurry.
That.
No, that's okay. I think the pub just opened. It's the afternoon time, and someone's headed to the pub. Now you are in England, but due to the marvels of modern communication, you can work with people everywhere, I assume.
Absolutely.
How do people get a hold of you if they want to get more information on X-ray, or if they want to hire you as a consultant? What's the best way for people to find you, David?
The simple way is I'm on LinkedIn, and I also have an email address, which I'm happy to give you if that's appropriate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Please do.
It's DBC, that's Delta Bravo Charlie, at Bernard, that's my surname, .abel.co.uk. And as I said, I'm happy, because hopefully if I can help people use the technique better, I think it will only not only give them value, but also encourage equipment manufacturers and others in order to improve the offering to make it. But also I've got to give the caveat is I can't guarantee an instant response.
Right. Well, if one is busy, one is busy. But you've helped me a lot understanding in more detail the intricacies of X-ray and the subtleties of X-ray technology. Thank you so much, Dr. David Bernard, for being my guest on Reliability Matters. This has been a joy of a conversation, and I think our listeners will agree. This is a topical and valuable subject matter. I really appreciate you being my guest.
Thanks very much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to Reliability Matters. If you like what you hear, please be sure to give us a like. Just click the like or heart button below. If there are any reliability-based questions you'd like to have answered or specific topics discussed, let me know. I can be reached at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Don't miss another episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes or follow us on Spotify. You can also listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, aqueoustech.com, pcbchat.com, Spreaker.com, or our newest affiliate, Ascendo Reliability, on reliability.fm, a site dedicated to all things reliability. Once again, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Reliability Matters. In the meantime, keep doing it right.